All right, good morning, everybody. We got Bio 241, and it's September 22nd. And let's see, on Monday we went through a big upgrade in Blackboard, and I've talked to a few students, and they've had some success using Blackboard or accessing Blackboard on their mobile phones.
Oh, yeah.
So if you want to try that, they've taken some quizzes online. You took a quiz online. Okay, so I know iPhone works supposedly if they have a Wi-Fi connection, but some people just accessed it directly via their network connections. They didn't need to use a Wi-Fi. But if you ever do take a quiz or any kind of four-credit information in the class, remember, how many times can you take a quiz? Unlimited number of times, that's right. So if you take a quiz on your cell phone, always go to a computer someplace and check, make sure that it got loaded properly. There was a couple circumstances where somebody took a quiz and I had no indication whatsoever that they had even attempted to take it. So just double check on a computer until we know. All right, so it should be working with Internet Explorer 9 and Chrome and the latest version of Firefox. But just kind of be careful until we know exactly what's happening. All right, I also had some questions about how do you access your electronic textbook that came with the purchase of your textbook. And let's look at this Blackboard announcement page. This is where when you log into Blackboard and you click on this course, this is where you're taken to. Right here, this is just the first page. And to get access, you have to put in that number that came with your textbook. So click on Tools right here, and then it's going to load a number of different icons. Some of these I've hidden. But some I want you to see, like grades. I want you to see your grades. That's in there. But here's McGraw-Hill Higher Education. If you click on this, somewhere you should be able to, okay, since I've paired the class up already and logged in, you're going to have probably an icon that says go to my Connect section. All right, Connect is the online version of this textbook. So if you click on that, then it's going to ask you for your access code. And at that time, you might want to put in a username and password. All right, but once you access it with your access code, anytime you log into Blackboard, then you don't have to log back into Connect. It will automatically you'll have access to it. But if you're just mousing around, browsing around the internet, and you don't want to log on to Blackboard, you can go to that URL that I sent to you in the email, and then put in your username and password and get to Connect as well for the electronic textbook. All right, so that's really about the only thing that I have working right now for the McGraw-Hill activities. All right, so who's got a question on that? To get to the electronic textbook, click Tools, all right, and then McGraw-Hill, and then follow some instructions. All right, I can't really tell you how to do it here because I have instructor privileges, and so the screens look a whole lot different compared to the student editions. Yeah. The answers to? Ah, okay. Let's take a look. How about maybe under course documents or under course information? I'm not sure. I don't see it there. Course information. It's probably in the study guide someplace. Yeah, where are the study guides? Oh, I put a special button for study guides, didn't I? Exam study guides. Okay, so test your quantitative ability answer keys right here. So that would be for exam one, exam two. Here's check your quantitative ability answer key right here. Yeah, it's under study guides. Yeah, thank you. Okay. All right, so here's the slide we were looking at last time. Let's see, that's on the left-hand side. I think I want to put it on both sides, so I'm going to do this right here. Okay, so here's the initial slide. This was extra credit. A drawing for you, not the whole slide, but just a part of it. And last time I mentioned that probably the most important thing was left off this slide. Right, so we're looking at cellular respiration, both anaerobic and aerobic. We haven't talked about aerobic respiration yet, but we will today. But now's a good time to maybe ask, okay, what is the point of all of this biochemistry right here? We see, is the point to use up glucose? Is the point to make pyruvic acid, right? Is the point of cellular respiration to make lactic acid? Or what else could it be? Is the point of metabolism to make carbon dioxide and water? You're shaking your head no. And that's excellent, because what the most important concept is on the slide is left off. All right, but I did include it on the slide for you to draw in during your lab. All right, so what is the whole point of cellular respiration? It is to make ATP. So don't forget about the overview, the most important concept right here. And you might want to fill in some other kinds of things. Like maybe over here, in order for anything to happen inside the mitochondria, what does a mitochondria need? It needs oxygen. So you might just want to draw an oxygen, right, as participating in this process right here someplace. I'll show you where it fits in just a little bit. Oxygen is not required for what's happening inside the cytoplasm. All right, so let's just finish off some concepts and how your body uses anaerobic respiration. All right, so here is a really good figure, probably an exam figure too, of the Cori cycle. And so we got skeletal muscle on the left, and we have liver cells on the right, and they're linked by various kinds of metabolism and, of course, by the blood. Blood is flowing through both organs, one right after the other. All right, so when a muscle, a skeletal muscle, exercises, it requires ATP. When we get to muscles, we'll look at that process in particular. So the mitochondria inside muscle cells have to be making a lot of ATP all the time. But when a muscle is contracting, blood can't get into the muscle, so it's not delivering oxygen. And as a result, aerobic respiration cannot take place. Only anaerobic respiration takes place. And if you look at that very first slide, by glycolysis, how many ATP can be made for every glucose? There's only two. Yep, but two is better, a lot better than nothing. All right, so here we have a number of pathways. So glucose 6-phosphate going to pyruvic acid. Okay, what would you call two? Okay, so it's maybe not really clear in your book, but it's got to be really clear in your mind. So from glucose to pyruvic acid, that's clipping glucose in half, basically, that is what? That's glycolysis, right? That's just clipping glucose in half. And what about going from pyruvic acid to lactic acid? What enzyme is necessary there? That's called lactate dehydrogenase. Right? So that's lactate dehydrogenase, and then lactic acid can leave the cell and go into the blood. And when it's in the blood, where does it go? Where does lactic acid go once it's in the blood? Everywhere that blood goes, right? Including the liver. So now the circulatory system has delivered lactic acid to the liver, and liver cells will then take up lactic acid and can reconvert it back to pyruvic acid with the same enzyme, lactate dehydrogenase. There's almost no free energy change in these two compounds right here, so it can be converted back to pyruvic acid. And then the liver has the ability to take pyruvic acid and turn it into glucose. So how does that happen? How many pyruvic acids are necessary? You need two, right? Because pyruvic acid is a 3-carbon molecule, glucose is 6. So the liver has the ability to run glycolysis in the reverse direction. Aha! But what do we call that officially in this class? That is gluconeogenesis. Gluconeogenesis. Right? So 6 is gluconeogenesis, and then what's 2 over here? We flip back to where we were before. That's glycolysis, right? So glycolysis and gluconeogenesis are like antagonistic biochemical pathways. All right, so then the liver can do a couple things with glucose 6-phosphate. It can convert it into glycogen, right? And if it converts it into glycogen, what's the name of that process? So I do want you to be able to name this arrow right here. What is this arrow? That's glycogenesis. That's the making of glycogen from glucose. Okay, and the other thing that can happen to glucose 6-phosphate is that maybe the liver wants to just secrete that glucose back into the blood because other organs might need it, like for instance skeletal muscle that is exercising. Glucose 6-phosphate cannot leave the liver cell. Does anybody know why glucose 6-phosphate can't leave the cell? Yeah, because of that phosphate group, it's highly ionized. It has a lot of negative charges on it, so it's a highly polar compound. So polar compounds can't get through the membrane. So what's the name of the enzyme that takes a phosphate off of something? It's a phosphatase, and then we could name it after the substrate that we have right here. So number 7 would be glucose 6-phosphatase. 7 is glucose 6-phosphatase. And then glucose is now can be secreted by the liver cell, goes into the blood, and when glucose is in the blood, where does it go? Everywhere in the body, including back to these muscle cells that are exercising. They'll gladly take it up. Okay, and when it gets inside the cell, it's phosphorylated immediately so that it can't leave. And glucose 6-phosphate has two possible fates when it's inside that muscle cell. It can be used to make ATP via what process? Glycolysis. Yeah, at least two measly ATP. Or if that muscle cell is no longer exercising and it has an abundance of energy, that glucose can be stored in the form of glycogen. All right, and so what's number 9 over here? Glycogenesis. And then when that muscle starts exercising again, what happens to that glycogen? It gets broken down, yeah? And what's that process? So what's number 1 over here? Glycogenolysis. Yeah, glycogenolysis. So we've got glycogenolysis, glycogenesis, and that's exactly how you would label these arrows over here in the liver as well, right? So you could put like a number 1 and a number 9, but make sure you're familiar with, oh, one thing I forgot. So glucose gets into the muscle cell, right? So we got glucose here. How does glucose get converted into glucose 6-phosphate? Okay, what kind of enzyme will phosphorylate something? A kinase enzyme, right? So glucokinase is the name of the enzyme that can take glucose and make glucose 6-phosphate out of it. All right, and when it does so, that glucose now is trapped inside the cell, can't leave, and then the muscle cell is happy because it has that energy supply. All right, so but in order for the liver to undergo gluconeogenesis, taking lactic acid and making glucose out of it again, it needs oxygen and it needs ATP. So there's some metabolic cost, but at least this process allows the muscle cell to remain active even in the presence of low oxygen. Okay, but the liver is doing part of the job because it's operating aerobically. All right, so those are those 4 terms that you got to be familiar with. What are the 4 terms? Glycolysis, glycogenesis, glycogenolysis, and gluconeogenesis, right? So if those words aren't, make sure you can spell them if they're not making sense to you. If you can't see them on the page, like I said, then you need some better reading glasses, okay? Because you got to be familiar with that. All right, so let me flip back to this very first slide once again right here. So we're pretty much done talking about the respiration in the cytoplasm, but now if there is oxygen present, then pyruvic acid can enter mitochondria, but that's only if oxygen is present and some other metabolic pathways can take place. This first little arrow right here, you might want to just draw in preparatory reaction. All right, it's just a little tiny arrow right here, but it's a prep reaction. All right, and then you got the Krebs cycle, and then you've got electron transport. So there are basically 3 important biochemical pathways that are taking place inside the mitochondria. One would be the preparatory reaction. The second would be a series of reactions we call the Krebs cycle. And then the third one is what we call electron transport. All right, and again, these processes are going to produce ATP. So let's just review really fast. When we were talking about the cytosol right here, glycolysis is what's producing ATP for us, right? And how many ATP are produced by glycolysis for every glucose? 2. And that does not require oxygen, right? Okay. And when ATP is produced by a biochemical reaction, like just the simple conversion right here, we call this substrate level phosphorylation. All right, so we're going to say substrate level phosphorylation is how ADP is converted into ATP by glycolysis. Substrate level phosphorylation. All right, so you're just going to have to hold on to that for just a second. All right, so where are we? Aerobic respiration. Now we got to start thinking about mitochondria, because in order for mitochondria to do their job, they need oxygen. All right, so here is that preparatory reaction, that first very little arrow. All right, it begins when pyruvic acid or pyruvate, formed by glycolysis, enters the mitochondria. A carbon dioxide or a CO2 molecule is clipped off of pyruvate. All right, and so if pyruvate loses, here's the CO2 group that gets clipped off, how many carbon atoms are left? So there's 2 left, and that's what we call an acetyl group. A two-carbon fragment is an acetyl group. And of course, when you clips off a CO2, what do you have? You have just carbon dioxide. So what organelle produces carbon dioxide that we have to exhale from our bodies? Is it Golgi? Endoplasmic reticulum? Nucleus? What organelle does that? Mitochondria. That's right. So now you know mitochondria are those guys that are producing CO2 that we have to exhale. All right, so here we have that acetyl group. It's going to be carried from one set of reactions to another. What do we call something that carries a molecule from one biochemical pathway to another biochemical pathway? It's a coenzyme, and it's a big, large molecule. It's not a cofactor, but a coenzyme, and it's so complicated that it doesn't even make sense to show you what that chemical looks like. But here is coenzyme A. It's coenzyme because it's going to carry an acetyl group from the preparatory reaction into the Krebs cycle. Right? In the process of removing a CO2 from pyruvate, then we also get one more NADH formed in the preparatory reaction. And can anybody tell me anything about NADH yet? What do you know about NADH? Is it a coenzyme or is it a cofactor? It's a coenzyme. It's a really big organic molecule. So it's something that carries some entity from one chemical reaction to another chemical reaction. And what the heck is NADH carrying? High energy electrons. That's right. And you saw that in the very last chapter, the very last page. So it has ability to carry high energy electrons. So in this step right here, this preparatory reaction, we don't see any ATP directly being made, but we do see some NADH being made, and it's carrying some high-energy compounds, and we're going to see that later on inside the mitochondria, those high-energy electrons can be used to phosphorylate ADP. All right, and when ADP is phosphorylated, what do you get out of it? You get ATP, which is the energy molecule that we're interested in forming. So this right here is the prep reaction, preparatory reaction. And your book is just a little bit sloppy, in that when you try to balance this oxidation-reduction reaction out, NAD is missing something right here. What is it missing? It's missing that plus. Yeah, it's really an ion, right? It's really a plus. NAD, there's a plus, and then it accepts a hydrogen ion and two electrons, and so NADH is actually neutral. So I know some students look at that when they're studying, right? And if you get off the right track, it's because the book doesn't always put that little plus right there, which it probably should. All right, so coenzyme A is involved in the preparatory reaction. In what organelle are we talking about? Mitochondria in particular. And I don't see oxygen, okay, being used at this step, but eventually we're going to see where oxygen plays an important role. Okay, so next slide. Here we have a picture of the mitochondrial membrane right here. And so here's cytoplasm. Here we have, sign-in sheet. Somebody's going to have to get a sign-in sheet started. Who can do that? You can do that? Fantastic. Okay, so here's pyruvic acid, which is three carbon atoms. It enters the mitochondria, and then here is the preparatory reaction. And it needs coenzyme A, and needs NAD+, and then this decarboxylation can take place. Decarboxylation produces the CO2, and then we have acetyl coenzyme A formed. That acetyl group is just a two-carbon fragment. Coenzyme A is the carrier molecule which takes it to the Krebs cycle. So here is the Krebs cycle. And the Krebs cycle starts with a four-carbon molecule, and if we add two carbons to it, what do we end up with? A six-carbon molecule. And I don't think it's important in this class that you know the names of these compounds, but if you're interested in that, there are other good classes in chemistry where you learn all this kind of stuff. Right, but I do want you to see that a four-carbon and a two-carbon molecule join together, and that's what we call citric acid. And then there are rearrangements and decarboxylations within the Krebs cycle, right, to where you end up back again here at oxaloacetic acid, which is a four-carbon fragment. So if you add to the Krebs cycle two carbons in one turn of the Krebs cycle, how many carbons have to be released in order to get back to where you started with? Okay, yeah, you get back to four, but you have to convert all of those carbons that were in acetyl-CoA into what, carbon dioxide. And you can see two carboxylation steps right here. And these are exergonic reactions. So the Krebs cycle is exergonic. It's releasing energy. Right? And we're going to see that some of the energy that's released is trapped in high energy electrons. But there's one step that directly phosphorylates ADP into ATP. Just a chemical reaction. Right? So here is, for one turn of the Krebs cycle, it produces one guanosine triphosphate. And GTP basically has the same free energy as ATP, so a GTP can be used to make an ATP, phosphorylate an ATP very easily. And then three NADHs. And can anybody remember if this is an oxidized or a reduced form of NADH? What is reduction once again? Just the definition of reduction. It's when a molecule accepts electrons, gains electrons. Okay, and what do we know about NADH? What is it carrying? What do I want you to know about? What is it carrying? High energy electrons. So if it's carrying high energy electrons, it means it has accepted electrons, so this is the reduced form of NAD. Okay. The same thing for FADH2. This is the reduced form of FAD, and it's carrying some high energy electrons as well. Right, and so then NADH and FADH2 are going to carry these electrons to another part, another biochemical pathway inside the mitochondria that we call the electron transport chain. All right, so let's now look at the Krebs cycle in just a little bit of detail. All right, so here we have acetyl-CoA, and you can see the nice two-carbon fragment right here. Here is coenzyme A. It's carrying this acetyl group into the Krebs cycle. So now we have a six-carbon molecule, citric acid, and through a number of different rearrangements and a decarboxylation, we can see that NAD plus is reduced to NADH in this step. So how many NADHs do you see being produced by the Krebs cycle right here? I see one right here. I see one right here that is linked to another decarboxylation reaction. Okay, and then here is the third one. All right, so every turn of the Krebs cycle produces three of these NADHs. All right, now for every glucose, how many turns of the Krebs cycle are there? Because how many carbons are in glucose? There are six. It produces two pyruvic acids, so for every glucose, two acetyl-CoAs are produced. So for every glucose, you get two turns of the Krebs cycle right here. So for every glucose, you don't get three NADHs, you actually get what? You get six NADHs right here because it has to go around twice. All right, at this step, we see that, and you don't have to know the names of these compounds, but alpha-ketoglutarate to succinic acid right here will phosphorylate guanosine diphosphate into guanosine triphosphate, and then that is coupled with the phosphorylation of ADP into ATP. So for every turn of the Krebs cycle, by itself, it produces an ATP molecule. And this just requires these enzymatic steps. So this is, again, another example of substrate-level phosphorylation, just like what we saw in glycolysis, substrate-level phosphorylation. Okay. The other thing that happens then, in this step, we get FADH2 produced, which is the reduced form of FADH. And what is FADH2 carrying? High energy electrons. So again, that's a coenzyme. NADH is a coenzyme carrying high energy electrons. Now, again, when you look at this reaction right here, I don't see any oxygen, but the Krebs cycle can only turn and produce these high energy intermediates and this one ATP molecule only when oxygen is present inside the mitochondria. I don't want to forget about that. Okay, so that's why we say that for every turn of the Krebs cycle, it produces one GTP, and if you want to put an ATP there, that's fine with me. Three NADHs and one FADH2. All right, so then your body can use that ATP for whatever purpose it wants, but now we have to concern ourselves, what happens to those high energy electrons that are trapped in NADH and FADH2? Yeah.
Sorry, just a quick question. Yeah.
Okay, you would have to know that for every glucose, you get two turns of the Krebs cycle. Okay, so it would be, for the Krebs cycle, for every glucose would be 6 NADHs and 2 FADH2s and 2 ATP. But if the question says for every acetyl-CoA, then you would say 3, 1, and 1. Yeah. So you should be aware at that level, okay, that every glucose will produce 2 acetyl-CoAs. Okay, so we've got these high-energy electrons now trapped in these coenzymes. And the coenzymes can release those high-energy electrons to other molecules through oxidation-reduction reactions, right? And those high-energy electrons can flow from one compound to another. These compounds are embedded in the inner mitochondrial membrane. Oh, I might want to go to the next couple slides here. All right, because I want you to have a picture of what a mitochondria looks like on the inside. Mitochondria has, okay, an outer membrane and an inner membrane that forms cristae, and there's a space between the two membranes. All right, so this right here is what we call the matrix inside the mitochondria, and this space between the membranes is called the intermembrane space. And here we can see a number of compounds embedded in the inner membrane or the cristae membrane of the mitochondria that can accept electrons, and then the electrons are passed from one compound to another, right through the center of the membrane right here. So all of these compounds kind of act like an electrical wire that transmit electrons from one compound to another. And as they jump from one compound to another, they release some energy. So this is the slide we were looking at. All right, so let's start with NADH, carrying those high energy electrons. And so here's a scale of free energy. There's a lot of energy in NADH. Then they're transferred to a protein called FMN. Right? And so when FMN is reduced, right, it becomes FMNH2. And what happens to NADH when FMN is reduced? It becomes oxidized, right? And now you have NADH to participate in the Krebs cycle to keep the Krebs cycle going. Because if you don't have NADH, let's go back to here. If you don't have NADH, right, then this step here gets blocked. Or if you don't have NADH over here, then this conversion gets blocked, right? So this NADH has to be used up somehow inside the mitochondria to keep the Krebs cycle working. All right, let's go back to this slide right here. All right, and then when this first compound is reduced, it will pass electrons to another compound that we call coenzyme Q. You don't have to know the names of these compounds. You should just all be aware that there is just a series of steps of oxidation reduction reactions where electrons hop from one chemical compound to another, to another, to another. Right, and most of these are what we call cytochromes that can accept these electrons. Here you see one cytochrome C1 and C. They have an iron atom that changes its ionic state when it's reduced or oxidized. And as these electrons lose their energy, being transferred from one chemical compound to another, right, it's a highly exergonic step when cytochrome B reduces cytochrome C1. That's exergonic. And that excess energy can be used to do what? To phosphorylate ADP and make ATP out of it. So what this diagram shows is that the highest energy molecule we have is NADH. Okay, and as these electrons lose energy, give up energy, ATP can be produced. Right, and this is what we call the electron transport chain, because what's being transported from one molecule to another? These high-energy electrons that you get from NADH or FADH2. Another thing that this diagram shows you is that which compound has higher energy electrons? Is it NADH or FADH2? And here you see the axis of free energy. So NADH has more energy available than FADH2. So as a matter of fact, for every single NADH molecule, how many ATPs can be produced? We see 3, right? And for every FADH2, how many ATPs can be produced? Yeah. Only 2, so there's a little bit of reduction. All right, so those are some of the ballpark numbers that I want you to know in this class. For every NADH, it produces 2 ATP. For every FADH2, it's just 2. That's the theoretical maximum yield of ATP. In real life circumstances, it's going to be a little bit less than 3. It might be 2.5, it might be 2.2. depending on the circumstances. And you know what? Scientists will be trying to understand that process probably for the next couple hundred years. And as maybe I said before, with cytokinesis, you have to take an exam in here before a couple hundred years is up. Right, so what I want you to know is 3 ATPs for every NADH, 2 for every FADH2, but realize that's under the most ideal circumstances, and there are probably some losses, energy losses in the system, where it's rare that that condition is really met, but I think that's a good place for you to start. Yeah, question?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I know your book goes into quite a bit of detail. Is it really 3 or 2.5 or whatever? But I think for our purposes, just relate your understanding to this diagram right here. So how many ATPs do you see? 4 NADH, yeah, it's 3. Now in lab, your lab instructors might wish to pick on a particular condition, right? So on a lab quiz, please pay attention to what your lab instructor says. But you can tell your lab instructors that in lecture, 3 and 2 is what I'm wanting you to know. Okay. So these electrons move through electron transport chain, and if for whatever reason, somehow cytochrome C1, this conversion of cytochrome B to a reduced form here of cytochrome C1, if this is blocked, right, then electrons can't get through this blockage right here, right? And if this step is blocked, then electrons can't even be transferred from NADH to FMN. So if there's a blockage over here, it backs up electron transport all the way from the beginning, right? So those electrons have to keep flowing through electron transport chain in order for these ATP to be produced. So a question I usually get is then, where do these electrons go? Because you can't afford to have them back up to pile up anyplace, because that's going to have, by the law of mass action, will stop the electron transport chain and the production of all of these ATPs right here. So what gets rid of those electrons so that they can keep flowing through the ETC? And here we see some oxygen, right? So these electrons, right, from this very last step, from cytochrome A3, these high energy electrons don't have a whole lot of energy, but enough to reduce oxygen to form water. Okay, so oxygen is necessary to keep ETC working, to produce all these ATP, which is the reason why we have to do what in our daily life? At least every 15 seconds. Breathe in to get oxygen, right? To keep this electron transport chain operating to produce ATP for us. All right, now, where is this taking place? What organelle needs oxygen to produce all these ATP? Mitochondria, once again, right? So the mitochondria are producing CO2 that we have to breathe out. Mitochondria also need oxygen via a different biochemical pathway, okay, namely the ETC, to make ATP. Another interesting thing that I can point out, what is the last molecule that is actually produced by electron transport chain? Yeah, is water, which is what? The solvent that we're all dissolved in. That's just really kind of fascinating, that something that is a solvent is what? A very important metabolite in many kinds of chemical reactions, especially this one right here, which is what? The most important in producing ATP for us. All right, so if we take oxygen away, what happens to electron transport chain if we take oxygen away from it? It backs up and it stops, and all this ATP can't be made, and then you run out of ATP very quickly as a result of that. Okay, so this step of forming ATP, because it requires oxygen to accept those electrons, is what we call oxidative phosphorylation. So oxidative phosphorylation is inherently different than substrate level phosphorylation. So where does oxidative phosphorylation take place? In the mitochondria, and in particular the Christi membranes, or the inner mitochondrial membrane, is where oxidative phosphorylation takes place. But what about substrate level phosphorylation? Where does that take place? There are two places. One is in the cytosol, because ATP is produced by substrate phosphorylation by glycolysis, but also by the Krebs cycle, that one step in the Krebs cycle, and that's inside the matrix of the mitochondria. Okay, the matrix is what part of the mitochondria? Oh, I gotta go this way, sorry. The matrix of the mitochondria, okay, is over here. This is where the Krebs cycle is taking place, right? Is that the innermost part of the mitochondria. All right, so, yeah, question. Oh, substrate level phosphorylation, two places where substrate level phosphorylation takes place is, okay, Krebs cycle right here. Here's ATP being produced by substrate level phosphorylation in the Krebs cycle, and the Krebs cycle takes place in the matrix of the mitochondria. The second place, right, is in glycolysis. Here's an ATP and here's an ATP. There's two steps of substrate level phosphorylation in glycolysis, and that's in the cytosol, right? That's before any of these intermediates enter the mitochondria. Okay. And you can see glycolysis, don't forget, actually produces 4-ATP, but in order to get glycolysis working, what has to happen? You have to expend 2 ATPs to get it working. So the net gain is just 2 ATPs for glycolysis. All right, so that's aerobic respiration. Okay, oxidative phosphorylation, highly exergonic process. All right, this probably is an exam figure right here. And it's kind of nice because it shows the outer membrane of the mitochondria, the Christi membrane. It shows where the electron transport chain exists. Where does the electron transport chain exist in the mitochondria? It's embedded in the Christi membrane. It's in that Christi membrane, the inner mitochondrial membrane, right? And when electrons move from one electron acceptor to another, right, it loses energy, and that energy of these electrons can be used to take protons that are in the matrix and pump them into the intermembrane space. So when we say pump, what does that mean in terms of concentration? Are these protons right here, or hydrogen ions, are they going to go from low concentration to high if they're being pumped? They're going to go from low concentration to high concentration in the intermembrane space. And what's required? Right, is that diffusion when you go from low to high? Is that diffusion? No, that's the opposite of diffusion. That's an active process that requires energy. Where does that energy come from? Okay, usually a pump is going to require ATP, but in this particular case, it's coming from these high energy electrons that are donated to ETC by NADH and FADH2. All right, so there are protons that are pumped into this inner membrane space. And how many are proton pumps do we have right here? 1, 2, 3, right? So that kind of pairs up nicely for every NADH. How many ATPs are used in the best ideal circumstance? 3 ATPs, and I see 3 nice proton pumps right here. That's one way to help remember that. So now you have a high concentration of hydrogen ions in the inner membrane space, low in the matrix. And what do these hydrogen ions want to do? Okay, if you just to go down their concentration gradient, to go back into the matrix right here, okay, because there's a huge concentration gradient. And, of course, they can't get through the membrane by themselves because they're polar compounds, right? But here is a third kind of protein that's embedded in the matrix. And it's a proton channel. And on the matrix side, there's also an ATPase or an ATP synthetase enzyme. And it can take ADP and inorganic phosphate that's in the matrix, and it can use the energy in the ion gradient of the protons to make ATP out of it. So as protons flow through this, what we call a respiratory assembly, then ADP is made by this process right here. And so this is actually oxidative phosphorylation taking place on this molecule right here. And this is a pretty big molecule. You can see it on electron micrographs on the inner mitochondrial membrane, right? And it's using the gradient of hydrogen ions from the intermembrane space down into the matrix to make ATP. So that's what we call an ATP synthetase. Right, so we have a number of proton channels. Remember, these protons can't get through the membrane unless there's a special channel that opens and closes. And the ATP synthase or synthetase is special because it can use that energy of the flow of protons through this protein to phosphorylate ATP, right? But in order for electrons to flow, what accepts those electrons so that they don't back up? Do you see it on this slide? It is what? Oxygen right here. All right, so that's why we call this oxidative phosphorylation, because it's all dependent on oxygen being available to accept those electrons, right, in the very last step of the electron transport chain. So this theory right here is what we call the chemiosmotic theory of oxidative phosphorylation. So it's just the coupling of the proton gradient across the Christi membrane and the respiratory assembly to make ATP, as long as oxygen is present. So that's pretty fascinating how that all worked. Some Nobel Prizes were won when people figured out how that actually worked. Okay, so what organelle is this right here? Mitochondria. So mitochondria, okay, when they have oxygen, are very beneficial to us because they can make ATP. But when mitochondria run out of oxygen, they still want to maintain a high concentration of hydrogens in this intermembrane space, hydrogen ions in this intermembrane space. And they start to work against our cells. Right, so what is one way for mitochondria under low oxygen concentrations to keep the concentration of hydrogen ions high in this intermembrane space right here? Without oxygen, electron transport chain can't be working, so these proton pumps aren't working. Right, but look at this respiratory assembly right here. It has an ATPase. So when mitochondria run out of oxygen, they take ATP, okay, convert it into ADP, and they pump protons in the reverse direction. All right, now what happens to us when that happens? The mitochondria feel fine because now they have a high to low concentration of protons, but what happens to us? We run out of ATP when that happens. So that's going to be an interesting part of medicine when somebody figures out how to manipulate these respiratory assemblies to prevent that from happening when somebody's having a stroke or heart attack or something, and that will preserve the level of ATP inside of ourselves until this situation can be corrected. All right, so that's the chemiosmotic theory. And I think we talked about this already, the necessity of oxygen. The last molecule that's actually made is, what, water right here, and ATP synthetase. Okay, so ATP, just to reiterate, can be made two different ways. Direct, which we call substrate level phosphorylation. That's just when enzymes break bonds and then put bonds back together in a different way. Both ATPs and glycolysis are made that way. Right, and two ATPs for every glucose in the Krebs cycle is made that way, the substrate level phosphorylation. Right, oxidative phosphorylation takes place when those electrons are transmitted from one compound to another through the electron transport chain. And when that happens, all the NADH and FADH2s that are made by glycolysis, also the prep reaction and the Krebs cycle, then can be used to generate ATP. And in that slide that I gave you for lab, what did I say, 36? Okay. All right, so that's not bad. That's the theoretical maximum yield. Under certain circumstances, it might not be high as that, so the book kind of derates that figure. So the yield, all depends on the various conditions. All right, and your book also talks about these hydrogens. And what I really want you to appreciate is what the high-energy electrons that are being used. And if you want to track the hydrogen of these protons through there, it will lead you to the same point. All right, so 3 ATP are produced for each pair of NADHs. 3 ATP for each pair of electrons in NADH. 2 ATP for FADH2. So 26 ATP produced by electron transport chain. All right, so we could calculate all this stuff right here. On this table, the only thing that I would change is that for FADH2, what number would I substitute in here to make it nice and simple? 2, right? And for every NADH, instead of 2.5, I would say 3, right? So that's why my numbers are a little bit higher, more like 38 ATP instead of 30 that you see in this table right here. All right, so glucose 2 pyruvate produces 2 ATP by substrate level phosphorylation. Okay, these two NADHs that are made by glucose, by glycolysis, when they move from the cytosol into the mitochondria, they lose some energy. And the way that these electrons move into the mitochondria to be donated to the electron transport chain is that the NADHs are converted into, or these electrons are transferred to FADH2. So how many, so there's two FADHs produced by glycolysis once it enters the mitochondria. So some energy is lost. It's probably good that you realize that. That's why we have FADH right here by produced by glycolysis, because those electrons have to enter the mitochondria to donate those electrons to the electron transport chain. All right, what about the prep reaction right here? Pyruvate acetyl-CoA. No direct level phosphorylation of ATP, but for every pyruvic acid, it produces an NADH. This is inside the mitochondria, so there are no losses. It doesn't have to be converted into FADH2. So for every glucose, there are two acetyl-CoAs made, so two NADHs, right? So then 3 times 2, right, would be 6 right there. And then the Krebs cycle. It produces ATP by substrate level phosphorylation. So maybe if you want to look at your, I don't want to flip back and forth, but if you want to look at your Krebs cycle, you can see for every turn, there's one ATP. But for every glucose, how many turns are there? There are two. Okay. Not only is there substrate level phosphorylation taking place, but you get three NADHs and one FADH2, and then you can calculate the ATPs once those high energy electrons are donated to the electron transport chain. All right, so here is the big important take home message. When we compare, let's kind of look at the big picture once again, which is this thing right here. Okay. When we consider anaerobic respiration for every glucose molecule, how many ATPs are produced? That's pretty easy. We didn't modify that understanding at all. So two ATPs are produced, right? But under aerobic conditions, how many ATPs are produced? Depending on how you want to calculate it, right? There can be various numbers, but it's going to be at least 30-something. So this is what I want you to compare. What's a more efficient metabolism? Something that's making 2 ATP for every glucose or 30-something? Okay, so 30-something is much better, right? So talk to your lab instructor how they want you to calculate it, but that's the level that I want you to know, 2 versus 30-something. And I really don't care if it's 32 or 34 or 36 or 38. It's just what? A whole lot more. Aerobic respiration is much more efficient than anaerobic respiration. Yeah. No. No, I won't ask, you know, what's the yield of ATP from aerobic metabolism, and then give you answers of 30, 32, 34, 36, 38. I'll give you something like 1, 2, 5, 10, 35. Okay? So I want you to know 2 versus what? 30-something. Okay? That's important. Okay, so some other kinds of metabolism inside the cell besides glucose, right? Fats can be hydrolyzed, so a fat is a triglyceride, can be hydrolyzed into glycerol and fatty acids, right? And then they can be modified to run through the Krebs cycle. Now, what kind of carbon fragment does the Krebs cycle accept from the rest of cellular metabolism? What kind of carbon fragment is it going to be? Acetyl-CoA is carrying what kind of carbon fragment? How many carbons? 1, 2, 3. Well, pyruvate has 3, but remember that preparatory reaction is a decarboxylation step. So coenzyme A carries what? An acetyl group, which is what? A 2-carbon fragment. So these big, long fatty acids can be broken down 2 carbons at a time using coenzyme A, and those 2-carbon fragments from a fatty acid can be given to the Krebs cycle to produce a lot of NADHs, and of course that one ATP by substrate level phosphorylation and FADH2 as well. All right, and proteins can be broken down into amino acids, which then can be chewed up 2 carbon units at a time and run through the Krebs cycle to make ATP as well. And some of these pathways can interconvert carbohydrates into fats and proteins into fats and vice versa, except that here is something interesting. Once something is a fat, it can't be converted into a carbohydrate. And once something is a fat, it can't be converted into a protein. All right, so once we have fat inside our body, it just remains fat, can't be converted into any other kind of substance, or it can be converted into ATP. That's the only possible fate for fat. And the reason is, okay, has to do with the Krebs cycle. So what is the entry molecule, once again, to the Krebs cycle? This two-carbon unit right here. Okay, and these two-carbon units can only be broken down into what compound? CO2. This two-carbon unit right here can't be used to make a sugar or a protein. It can be used to make a fat, but it can't be used to make a sugar or a protein. And these intermediates of the Krebs cycle are based on sugar molecules, right? So the only way that the Krebs cycle and the production of NADH occurs is when you have at least some sugar in your diet in order to maintain the Krebs cycle right here. All right, so let me speak some more about that. Okay, so here we have a fat, which is what? A triglyceride. And what the heck is a triglyceride again? What are the building blocks of a triglyceride? Glycerol and fatty acids. And remember, fatty acids are just big, long hydrocarbon chains. So here you have a fat, and you see a bidirectional arrow. It can be broken down into glycerol and fatty acids. What kind of reaction would you use for that? That'd be a hydrolysis reaction, right? And then the blue arrow, I presume that's a nice blue arrow going the other way, that would be a dehydration synthesis reaction, right? So this would be done by a lipase, right? So a lipase is going to degrade a fat into glycerol and fatty acids, right? And then these fatty acids, we see, can be converted two carbons at a time into acetyl-CoA, right? So if it's a 10-carbon fatty acid, then it can be broken down into 5 acetyl-CoAs, and those 5 acetyl-CoAs can then turn the Krebs cycle 5 times, producing all those NADHs, right? What good are all those NADHs produced by the Krebs cycle? Because they're carrying high-energy electrons that can be donated to the electron transport chain to produce 3 ATPs for every NADH that is produced. All right, so a fatty acid, unlike glucose, how many turns of the Krebs cycle does glucose make? Just 2. But a fatty acid can be, what, many, many times depending on how long it is. And remember what those fatty acids look like for that first test? Really long, many 2-carbon fragments in them. Okay, one other step I want you to see right here. Glycerol is a 3-carbon molecule. It can be converted to any of these intermediates of glycolysis. So glycerol can actually be used to make glucose. What do we call that process when glycerol is used to make glucose? That would be gluconeogenesis, right? And glycerol can even be used under when we have a lot of energy in our bodies, can be stored as glycogen. So what do we call this process here? Glucose going to glycogen. That would be glycogenesis, right? So glycerol can because it's a 3-carbon molecule, but these 2-carbon molecules, notice, can't be converted into a 3-carbon molecule, because what is pyruvic acid right here? Is it? It's 3. So once something is stuck as a 2-carbon unit, it can only be converted from fat into energy by decarboxylation reactions in the Krebs cycle. So once something is a fat, it just remains a fat forever, unless it's going to be metabolized into energy. Because this step from acetyl-CoA to pyruvic acid is what, a one-way step or a bidirectional? You just have one arrow right there. Which has another little interesting kind of point. I talked about alcohol fermentation last time in class. And you guys are talking about fermentation, which is anaerobic respiration. In yeast, what do yeast do? They can take a pyruvic acid, which is what, 3-carbon atoms? What's pyruvic acid? And then we have NADH. And it's going to use up NADH. It's going to produce NAD. That's important to keep glycolysis working. right? If you run out of NAD+, then glycolysis will shut down. So under anaerobic conditions, this pyruvic acid is going to be converted into a CO2. This doesn't happen in us, but in yeast particles. All right, CO2 plus what other compound? If we have a 3-carbon going to CO2, what are we left with? A 2-carbon molecule. So we have CH3, right? And then this one right here. There's an OH and then an H right here. And we talked about this compound right there. What is that? That's adult beverage. That's ethyl alcohol, right? Now, how many carbons does ethyl alcohol have in it? Two. So what's the possible fate of alcohol when you drink it? What's it like doing? The ethyl alcohol can be converted into acetyl-CoA, which then can enter the Krebs cycle to make ATP. So that's handy because it's an energy molecule. But what else can happen to ethyl alcohol? The only other possible fate. It can gets converted into a fatty acid. So drinking ethyl alcohol is like eating a bar of butter. That's the only possible fate for alcohol inside your body. It can't be converted, it can't be used for gluconeogenesis, right? So that's unfortunately what happens to a lot of people's livers. It becomes very fatty when they have a lot of alcohol in their daily diet, right? Because alcohol is just a 2-carbon fragment. Yeah. Beer belly, yes. That's what's producing it. Yeah, but worse than that, that's kind of what's happening to their liver as well. And when the liver turns into fat, it's not doing its job doing other things that it should be doing. Oh, and there's something else that happens. When the liver becomes fatty, it also has a tendency to go into cancer. Okay, liver cancer as well. So everything in moderation. Not a daily consumption of alcohol is not recommended. Okay. So this slide, I don't think I want to talk about this slide right here just yet. Fat synthesis is what we call lipogenesis, just like glycogenesis is the production of glycogen. All right, so how do you make triglycerides? You need fatty acids and glycerol. It occurs mainly in adipose tissue and in liver tissues. So the liver can take alcohol, right, detoxify it by making a triglyceride out of it. And fats are a very efficient way of storing energy inside our body. All right, so if we take a gram of carbohydrate and a gram of fat and a gram of protein, we see that the energy yield in a gram of fat is about 9,000 calories, right, or 9 large calories or kilocalories. That's a calorie by a dietitian's formulation. But carbohydrates and proteins, for the same weight, for the same bulk, is only 4. So that's why fat is such an efficient way of storing energy inside of our bodies, because for the same weight to weight, there's a lot more energy with fats, and that's because is a fatty acid, is it a polar compound or a nonpolar compound? Is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It's hydrophobic. So the way that it's stored is without water. So it doesn't need a lot of water to package, like glycogen needs water. So not only when you store energy in glycogen, you have the glycogen molecule, but it needs to be packaged with water. But fatty acids, on the other hand, are not packaged with water, so it's really just, it's very densely packed energy as a result of that. Okay, lipolysis is the breakdown of fat into fatty acids, all right, and that's via hydrolysis reaction by lipase. And that produces acetyl-CoAs from free fatty acids. All right, so lipolysis is taking a triglyceride and breaking it down to glycerol and fatty acids. And then once you have a fatty acid, this is what can be done with it. Okay, and it's called beta oxidation. And beta oxidation is a chemical pathway that we see right here that also takes place in the matrix of the mitochondria. So let's see what happens. So here's a fatty acid. Here, every fatty acid has a carboxyl group on the end, right? And it's just a long hydrocarbon chain. So here's a carboxyl group. And there is an enzyme along with coenzyme A that will break off this two-carbon fragment. Right, it's going to require an ATP to get this started. Right, so now you have acetyl coenzyme A bound to, you have coenzyme A bound to the fatty acid, and then there can be an oxidation reduction reaction that will make some FADH2, right, through just a rearrangement of these double bonds right here. But eventually, this acetyl group is going to break away from the fatty acid, right, and you see that it makes another NADH, and that acetyl-CoA from the fatty acid can be donated to the Krebs cycle, right? And when that happens, what happens to the fatty acid? Yeah, it gets recycled. It's just shorter by two carbon atoms. So it gets recycled back up to this state right up over here, and another two carbon atoms can be taken off and produces another FADH2 and another NADH, and this can happen repeatedly until you run out of two carbon fragments in that fatty acid. All right, so again, for every FADH2, how many ATPs do I want you guys to say? Two. And for every NADH, I want you guys to say three right here. All right, so this is the reason why a fatty acid can generate many more ATPs compared to glucose, because remember, glucose can only run the Krebs cycle twice, but a fatty acid can be 5, maybe 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times, depending on the length of the fatty acid. Yeah. They can be interconverted. There are some metabolic problems that develop if they're not even numbers or if it's saturated or an unsaturated fatty acid. But, yeah, we don't have time to go into that biochemistry necessarily in here. All right, but what I do want you to take home is beta oxidation is a way to break down fatty acids to produce what? ATP. Okay, and how is a fatty acid broken down? Just by two carbon units at a time or an acetyl group at a time. So if it's a 10 carbon fatty acid, then it's broken down by 5 steps, right? If it's a 16 carbon fatty acid, then it can run through Krebs cycle, right, 8 times, which is what, many more times compared to glucose, which is only 2 times. So fatty acids can produce much more ATP. All right, so that's it. So where does beta oxidation take place? What organelle?
Mitochondria.
Okay. Let me finish by saying this. All right, the Krebs cycle, because it's using up, the Krebs cycle is producing NADHs, just like beta oxidation is producing FADH2s and NADHs. The Krebs cycle is producing NADHs and FADH2s. In order to keep the Krebs cycle working, what happens to those NADHs and FADH2s? What has to happen to them? Okay. As a matter of fact, in order for beta oxidation to take place, what does it need? Does it need NADH or NAD? That's another way of thinking about it. It needs NAD+. It also needs FAD, right? And if NADH just builds up inside the mitochondria, then that's going to stop beta oxidation. And it's going to also stop the Krebs cycle, right? So what does the mitochondria have in order to regenerate NAD from NADH? It's got to have oxygen, right? That very last step of the electron transport chain. And once NADH can be oxidized back to NAD+, and once FADH2 can be oxidized back to FAD, then these metabolic pathways can remain open, producing ATP for us, right? But oxygen has to be there. So beta oxidation, even though I don't see it in this chemical pathway right here, what does it require? It requires oxygen, okay? And the Krebs cycle. How does the Krebs cycle work? Under what kind of conditions? Even though I don't see oxygen participating in the Krebs cycle, you still should know that it requires oxygen at the end of the electron transport chain so that the NADHs can be converted back to NAD to keep the Krebs cycle working. Okay. All right, so those are the important concepts. All right, so make sure you come to class next week, and we'll figure out when the next test is going to be.